Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. Today's show is sponsored by Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe. Thank you if you entered our sweepstakes with Le Cordon Bleu. We'll be announcing the winner this month, so stay tuned. And if you happen to be a student at Le Cordon Bleu, tag us in your Instagrams so we can follow along. We'd also like to thank Castor and Pollux, maker of the brand new purposeful pet food line, Pristine. A lot of Bomb Squad members are proud pet parents, so you'll want to know all about this grain-free line made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. Do you have a pup you love? Do hashtag CherryBombPets on Instagram for a chance to win a year's supply of Pristine. We've loved all your photos, by the way, so thank you to everyone who has already done the hashtag CherryBombPets. We're all sort of animal crazy at CherryBomb HQ, so we have a good time looking at those photos. Today's show is all about the legacy of Judith Jones. As many of you know, the legendary editor passed away yesterday at the age of 93, so we've asked some women who knew her to call in and share what made Judith so special. We'll hear from Maher Joffrey and Joan Nathan, and we might even hear from Lydia Bastianich, should Lydia's plane land on time. As you can imagine, we put this show together fairly last minute, so thank you to everyone who has agreed to call in. Live radio, kids. But first up, we have writer Sarah Franklin and New York Times reporter Julia Moskin on the line. Sarah, Julia, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Carrie.
So, Sarah, let's start with you. You spent a lot of time with Judith as part of an oral history project you did for the Julia Child Foundation. Can you tell us how that came about?
Absolutely. It was one of those cases of, as Judith loved to say, being in just the right place at the right time. I was starting a degree in food studies, and the Julia Child Foundation was looking for someone to run an oral history of Judith Jones. She had just retired, and they were aware that this was a sort of really important moment in her life to capture her reflections on her life. And when I say she had just retired, I mean she had just retired, and she was 88 at the time. This woman worked doggedly until almost the very end of her life. And the only catch was that we had to get along, which I had been told was not always that easy with Judith. And so we set up a meeting, and she invited me to her house for tea. And we kind of hit it off right away. And we spent 6 months working together, recording interviews about her life and work in food, but also her work in literary publishing, how she came to get into publishing in the first place, her time in France, her long, long love story with the state of Vermont, and her personal life as well.
And I'm guessing you two did get along.
We did. At least I love to think so. I sort of fell in love with her. I'm happy to admit that among friends. And she kept inviting me back. So I'd like to think that it was, you know, there was at least some level of friendship there.
That is a good sign. What were some of your takeaways about Judith?
Gosh, there are so many, and it's really so fresh that it's sort of hard to parse some of that still. You know, I think the one that I think about all the time, I sort of feel like I hear her whispering over my shoulders, that you never follow anyone's path but your own, and that a career in food, as all of us in food know, is not a linear thing, and you have to be willing to make a lot of lateral moves and sometimes some backwards moves in order to eventually get ahead. And she was really keen on reminding me about that all the time in her own stories, and also sort of as a piece of advice. And, you know, the other one that I come back to again and again is just the power of stories. I think what always captivated her was finding the right person. She was not much for sort of media fanfare. And if someone didn't have a really good story to tell with a lot of integrity and depth, she wasn't interested at all. And she had no problem walking away from authors, many of whom went on to be bestsellers with other houses, but she didn't feel like kind of had the depth of story that she wanted a Knopf cookbook to have.
Can you tell us some of those authors who she did think had the depth of story?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the list is sort of astounding. So Julia Child was the first one in the cookbook front. That book, of course, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, was published in 1961.
And sorry to interrupt, but she legit gets credit for discovering Julia Child, correct?
Yeah, and totally deserved. The manuscript landed on her desk soon after she was hired at Knopf in 1957. And she was a junior editor. She wasn't even allowed into the editorial meetings at the time because she was not a senior editor. And so her colleague, Angus Cameron, actually went to bat for the book on her behalf. And it was Alfred Knopf, who was kind of a bon vivant in his own right, the founder of Knopf Publishing House, along with his wife, Blanche, who sort of said, let's give Mrs. Jones a chance here. And, you know, the rest is history, of course. Claudia Roden, Mater Jaffrey, Lydia Bastianich, M.S.K. Fisher, James Beard, Irene Kuo, Edna Lewis, Jacques Pepin. It's an astounding list. It's really the American cookbook canon.
I mean, it's almost unbelievable when, you know, I was doing some research and writing notes for today. Just typing out all those names, you got chills.
Yeah.
It's almost unfathomable.
Yeah, and I think the piece that a lot of people don't know about her, and I've been so glad to see this in a lot of her obituaries, is that she was also a really heavy-hitting literary editor. And the reason she got hired at Knopf in the first place is because she was responsible for the publication of The Diary of Anne Frank in English. As a secretary, when she was living in Paris after college, she pulled that manuscript from the slush pile. And she very defiantly went to her boss and said, we've got to publish this. And he was like, you've got to be kidding me. This is a kid. And Blanche Knopf caught word of that. Doubleday did go on to publish it. And, of course, it went on to be one of the best-selling books in history. Blanche Knopf had really wanted that title for Knopf, and they didn't get it. And she snatched Judith Jones up right away when she heard that she was responsible.
Incredible.
And Knopf, Judith right away was assigned these incredible names, some of whom people don't know very well anymore, but at the time they were rock stars in literature. Elizabeth Bowen, John Hersey, and her more contemporary novelists that everyone does know are Anne Tyler and John Updike, with whom she worked for the majority of his career. So she was really bringing sort of a literary prowess onto cookbooks and also using cookbooks to inform her literary works. It was this really interesting, unusual career. There's no one like her.
Let's talk about Edna Lewis, because you just finished a book on Edna Lewis.
I did, yeah. I, along with 20 other really amazing contributors. I can't take full credit for that.
Oh, it's okay. So tell us about your book, and then tell us about the relationship of Judith and Edna.
Sure. So the book is a collection of recipes and essays written by food writers and scholars and chefs celebrating the memory of Edna Lewis. And, you know, I think like many of the people that Judith worked with, a lot of these women kind of got forgotten to history. At least, well, that's beginning to change finally. But they weren't really celebrated fully in their time. Cookbooks were kind of considered literature light. They were women's stuff. And they were sort of seen as on the fringes. And as food has come more to the center of our culture, people have begun to realize that we missed a real opportunity to capture those people's stories while they were still alive. We've missed the boat on a lot of the greats. And so the idea for that book was to take 20 people who have been deeply inspired by Edna Lewis, some who knew her personally and some who only knew her through her books and her work, and have them write on her memory and sort of talk about why she was so incredibly important to American culture, to American cooking, to Southern cooking as the Black woman. And the result is this, like, just remarkable kind of quilt of remembrances and celebration of her legacy. And Judith and Edna started working together in the 70s. Edna Lewis was kind of a career freelancer. She became famous in New York working at Cafe Nicholson in the 50s. And after she left, she went on to work as a chef and caterer, but she never stayed anywhere particularly long, and she was always kind of gigging around. And she broke her leg at one point, and she decided to try writing a cookbook with this woman, Evangeline Patterson. And together, they put together the Edna Lewis Cookbook, which was this very sort of French-infused book of recipes that was very much a reflection of the kind of food that Edna Lewis was doing at Cafe Nicholson. It was sort of French-centric with a little bit of Southern inflection. And Judith Jones was interested in it, but it wasn't quite her thing. She felt like it wasn't sort of the real Edna Lewis talking. And so when the two of them were introduced, what Judith Jones wanted from Edna was something that was really more about her personal story of growing up in rural Virginia, in this really kind of remarkable, almost utopian community of self-sufficient Black people, some of whom had been freed slaves, including Lewis's grandparents. And the result of that collaboration was The Taste of Country Cooking, which came out in 1976 and is now considered the classic Southern cookbook, you know, really important part of the canon of American Southern cookery. So that, you know, that collaboration between Judith and Edna was so fruitful and so important. And it was a kind of American cooking that no one else had bothered to tell a story about yet. And it was from this kind of really radical purview that was really different from anything else that had been published.
What was their relationship like? Did Judith talk to you about that?
She did. You know, they really admired one another, and the proof is in the pudding there. Edna Lewis dedicated The Taste of Country Cooking both to the people of Freetown, which is where she grew up, and also to Judith Jones. And the quote was for her deep understanding. So I think there was a tremendous amount of respect between the two and this real reverence for storytelling and the art of storytelling, and that needed to be valued in American culture. And I think, you know, with the long history of African Americans and sort of the oral tradition, a lot hadn't been written down. And Judith saw that there was something that needed to be captured there that was really important, and that food was a way to do it in this almost kind of alternative, subversive way and get people to pay attention, people who might not otherwise have paid attention. And so I think those two women really understood that they could use one another in their colleague relationship and their friendship, but that, you know, they could each sort of bring each other to a new level. Judith also talked about the incredible friendship that Edna had with her husband, Judith's husband, Evan, and that the two would sit around listening to Bessie Smith records and drinking bourbon and just kind of chewing the fat. So she was around a lot. They cooked together a lot. Edna Lewis came up to Vermont with them a couple of times. Towards the end of Edna Lewis's life, she went up to Vermont with Scott Peacock, and they worked on The Gift of Southern Cooking together up there. And they, you know, they really had an intimate relationship.
So we also have Julia Moskin on the line. Julia, you interviewed Judith for the New York Times when her book, The Tenth Muse, was published. And I loved this sentence from your story. It said, "If there's one person I blame for the multitude of mustards and olive oils cluttering my cabinets, also the sticky shelf with three kinds of soy sauce, five vinegars, pomegranate molasses, and a once-used bottle of Marsala, it's Judith Jones." Tell us about your interview with Judith for that story.
Well, that was the first time that I had met Judith, but she really had been kind of a figure in my life for a long time. Julia Child was a tremendous character in my household when I was young, and I had been named after her. And
Really?
And also I had worked at Kitchen Arts and Letters, the famous cookbook store in New York. So Judith Jones was, you know, a legend, simply, and also someone who was correctly credited with kind of bringing a real new level of academic rigor to cookbooks, which, you know, as Sarah said, really had been dismissed as kind of like the ladies' books before that and as household. And she really brought this anthropological aspect and also the literary aspect of headnotes, which essentially didn't exist before Judith Jones, because she was the person who pushed for real explanations of what was being cooked. If you look at older cookbooks, it's just, you know, here's the recipe, add the Jell-O, stir in the grapes, combine as usual, chill until done. And, you know, that explanation of not only method but history is something that, you know, she really did bring. So I knew that about her. And also the fact that she had, having read Julia Child's diaries in the course of my reporting and my research, you really get a strong sense of, you know, that she went so far beyond the usual role of an editor. By the time that manuscript did land on her desk, it had already been edited and rejected and expanded and contracted by at least three other publishers who had sort of toyed with it and then rejected it. At one time, I think the first volume alone was as long as 1,300 pages. I had worked as a cookbook editor before I became a food writer, and knowing the challenge that it takes, even now, you know, when everything is digitized, to wrangle 1,300 pages, three authors, all of whom live in another country, into such a coherent and influential narrative that was so clear. You know, if it had not been had a clear single voice that it spoke with, that book would never have become the icon that it is. And that is really something that I attribute to her work. As a person, when I met her, yes, she's definitely starchy and a bit intimidating. You know, you feel when you meet her that she's earned that right, and she doesn't suffer fools gladly. But what I really admired in what I saw in the time that we spent together was, you know, this thing that she had, the self-respect and the respect for culture and civilization that in a way she brought to every meal. Many people say, oh, I hate cooking for myself. I don't like cooking for one person. What's the point? I'm just going to eat in front of the television. She would never do that. She set a table every night. She had, you know, what she called proper food. And, you know, I think that was part of what fed her sense of self. And I really admire that. I think it's something that more of us, you know, especially, you know, women of at the age of 83 would do well to emulate.
So you cooked with her. What was that experience like?
It was, you know, it was just one day, and I believe that she was, you know, she wasn't particularly cooking from a recipe. At that point, she had many tools and tricks up her sleeve. She had the Julia Child pegboard, so, of course, she knew exactly where every pot and utensil in her kitchen was, which
explain,
does make you a much better cook.
Explain what the Julia Child pegboard is for those who haven't seen that.
The Julia Child pegboard, actually there have been many, is a system of organizing your... essentially, you know, your cookware on the walls of your kitchen. It's something that Paul Child actually came up with to help Julia sort of organize all of her stuff. I spent part of last summer in Julia and Paul's Child house in Provence, where they replicated the pegboard system that they had in their home kitchen in Cambridge, and where a lot of her later TV shows were filmed. And it's simply a white pegboard, and the outline of every piece of cookware is drawn on it. So you only have to look at your 8-inch skillet and at the pegboard to know, okay, that goes there. Here is the egg beater, because there's an image of an egg beater. And, you know, having cooked in that kitchen, it speeds things up enormously. So that kind of practical help, as well as this, like, literary, cultural, anthropological aspect of cooking, is what I really took away from that day.
So tell us how she impacted how we eat today.
Well, I mean, you know, certainly there is no way we would be eating, you know, Ottolenghi hummus and, you know, cooking from Momofuku cookbooks. And, you know, there are so many, even though some of the books that she edited are now seen as, you know, well, of course there's a huge cookbook on Middle Eastern cuisine. There's a huge cookbook on classic Italian cuisine. Those cuisines had little interest or prestige in the United States at the time that she was working on those books. I mean, many people were traveling more, were becoming more open, but food in and of itself wasn't even particularly interesting, much less the idea that Americans would be, you know, making their own kimchi. It was unimaginable. And, you know, she opened that door to trained cooks, home cooks, but still people who had some skills to be able to go beyond what they thought they could cook. Because, you know, at that time, let's say in the 50s, right before Mastering the Art was published, there was such a great value placed on homemaking and entertaining for women, and food was very visual. You know, that's where all those Jell-O salads came from, you might say. She really wasn't very interested in that. She was concerned about technique and whether it tasted good.
Sarah, she really championed women at a time when it wasn't the thing to do. Any insight into why she gravitated toward female writers and cooks?
I think she would dispute that, actually. I think she would say that she went where the knowledge was. And, you know, at that time, most of the women that she worked with were not restaurant chefs. Restaurant chefs, of course, cook for, you know, the consumer. You know, they make things that people want. She was not very interested in that kind of cooking. And as Sarah said, you know, she was happy to reject cookbook manuscripts from very popular TV chefs and restaurant chefs and restaurateurs of all kind. She really wanted the people who knew. And, you know, to a great extent at that time, that was women.
Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, Julie is absolutely right. She had no interest in restaurant chefs, and so she wasn't sort of keen to track down the people who had opened a big new restaurant in New York, which indeed was beginning to happen during her heyday. But I also think she was very aware of the fact that there were limited opportunities for really smart women, and she was one of them, and she understood that. And if you look into the background of a lot of the women that she worked with, they were either highly educated and or extremely well-traveled. And these were a group of women that really had a lust for adventure and serious pursuit. And she recognized that in people. She wanted people with whom she could sort of fall down the rabbit hole and who were going to go there with her. And a lot of the people who didn't have other avenues to do that through careers were women because there were few opportunities at the time. And so cookbooks, sort of that group of women together created this path for themselves, this career path for themselves, where they could apply their, you know, their intellectual rigor and make something really resonant in American culture in a way that was visible to the public.
Sarah, what did she think of the modern food world?
Define modern for me.
Just everything that's going on today. I mean, social media, the explosion of videos and food on television, and just this obsession with food that didn't exist when she was editing all these women.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's when you've lived as long as she did, it's hard not to do a little of the, oh, back in my day. And you know, when you've lived 93 years, there you have a lot of decades to say that about. Certainly she understood the power of television, particularly because of Julia Child and what it did for her, for Julia, and what it did for her reputation, and also what it did for American home cooks. You know, TV came into the home, and that meant Julia came into the home, and people could learn by watching. And I think there was a certain respect for sort of the internet video phenomenon, if it was a really instructional video. But she had no interest in social media. She didn't get it. She didn't like the idea that people needed to have a platform before they had a book. She said to me several times, the book is your platform. The idea being that your book should be your debut into the world, not your sort of business card once you already have a big name. And the one thing that she really, really hated about American contemporary food culture was waste. She talked to me incessantly about how disgusted she was about sort of the throwaway food culture and the enormous portions that were served both at home and in restaurants. And, you know, I think if you think back, this was a woman, even though she grew up with great privilege, who grew up during World War II and went to college during the war. And so Victory Garden and the effects of the Depression really shaped her world as a young woman. And being in Paris after World War II, you know, there was tremendous scarcity. And she spoke about the sort of gleeful cheers that went up when the first baguettes were baked again with pure flour rather than integrating a little bit of sawdust to kind of fill out the dough. And so she had tremendous respect for ingredients, and she didn't like that people would sort of fill up their fridges and then end up throwing half of that away.
She did seem to live modestly. I mean, I never visited either of her homes, but Julia, in your story, there's the picture of her Manhattan kitchen, and it looks very humble.
And yeah, definitely. I mean, as it's sort of the same ethos as that she brought to food. I think she brought to her home life, which was, you know, you don't need more than you need. When I met her, the bee in her bonnet was large bunches of herbs that you can only buy large bunches of herbs at the at the supermarket. Yes. And, you know, when you only needed, you know, one tablespoon of chopped fresh thyme, she just felt it was outrageous that you had to buy a whole one. And it was that kind of thing, you know, that really was the part of her that was very firmly in the New England tradition, not only the culinary tradition there, but also she and Evan Jones together wrote rich, deep, complicated histories of the food of the early United States. And that was the part of her work where she herself was also an historian and an academic.
Sarah, what was her Vermont home like?
If her New York City apartment is humble, her Vermont home was a hovel. I mean, it's not true at all, but it was literally this tiny little house built onto the side of a mountain, and the boards were stripped. There was no pegboard, but things were hung all over exposed beams. And she had, again, the huge black Garland stove that was in the house when they bought it, which they say is the reason why they bought it. And there were these rescued terracotta tiles that they used to help make their oven into a bread oven. The summer they bought that house, they went up to work on their bread book together. They were recipe testing there, so that was really important to them. And the really striking feature about the house is these plate glass windows, totally unadorned, not even sashes that looked out over to the Green Mountains. And they spent an enormous amount of time outside at that home. They were there primarily in the summer, and they swam in their pond. And they kept a garden, which they eventually gave up on because they realized gardening in the Northeast Kingdom is kind of a crazy endeavor. But it was an incredibly, incredibly simple house. And, of course, it was full of books.
Well, thank you both for your time. Sarah, when does your Edna Lewis book come out?
It'll be out in April of next year.
And Julia, your story is online for people who want to read it. And there's also a story by Kim Severson on the New York Times website today, remembering Judith Jones and her recipe for food writing. I'm very jealous that both of you got to cook with Judith. I never met her, but I'm glad both of you had the experiences you did.
Thank you for letting us come and talk about her.
All right, take care, and we'll be right back after this commercial break with Maher Joffrey.
Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle de Stael. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world, or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donna Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do, and as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
Welcome back, everybody. Our next guest is a food world legend. We've got Maher Joffrey on the phone. Maher, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Oh, wonderful to be with you on such a happy day.
It's, you know, I love hearing your voice. Oh, my gosh. You really have the most beautiful voice. So thank you for talking to us today. And, you know, I know you were close to Judith, so I'm sorry for your loss. But at the same time, you know, we were talking about this back at the Cherry Bomb office. What a life to celebrate. I mean, a legendary life, and a life that I don't even know you could repeat today.
No, I think it's the end of an era. There was a time when you had these giant editors. They were responsible. They cared for individual content. They weren't looking just to make money. You had to have something to say, and you had to be idiosyncratically yourself. And she would then buy you, as it were, for the firm. But she wanted an individual, not just something that would churn out a book that would make a lot of money. She had absolutely zero interest in that. She really looked for individual voices, just as you would in a writer. And in fact, she felt that food writers were no different. They were writers who happened to have a love of food.
Now, Maher, you are world famous today and have really helped introduce multitudes to Indian cuisine. But back when you were first starting out, your cookbook, you didn't have a lot of interest in your cookbook until it landed on Judith's desk, correct?
Well, there was no interest at all in Indian food. People knew very little about it, and nobody was really interested in it. And I was going from publisher to publisher. I was with a publisher, and then that publisher just went belly up. And suddenly I had this finished book, almost finished book, and nowhere to publish it. And a friend of a friend said, give it to Judith. So I said, here's the book. Please give it to her. And she bought it overnight. Next day I got a call, come in, I love your book. And she published it.
Now let's set...
just taking a chance on somebody who was not known at all.
And you weren't even really a cook. You were an actress, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Set the story for us. Tell us how that all came to be.
Well, I had studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. And I had studied drama in India, and I was on my way to America, where I thought this was the land of the best actor I knew, who was Marlon Brando. And it was my dream to be another Marlon Brando or something like that. That was what I had in my mind when I came to this country. And of course I came, and I got no work. Nobody wanted somebody who looked like me, who spoke like me. They felt there was no scope for me. I remember going to Joseph Papp at the Public Theater. And he auditioned me, and he said, what can we do with you? I'll try and place you. I remember his words so well. So, in other words, I wasn't acting. And then I started doing the next best thing, which is I knew how to... I had done, like Judith, I did English in college in India. That was my subject. And I could write. I mean, I didn't know I could write any particularly well, but I knew I could write. So I started writing for magazines, and the first magazine that asked me to write was, they said to me, and it was a magazine called Holiday Magazine, and they asked me to write an article about what I ate as a child in India. So I somehow got turned on to food without thinking about it. I always love food. I love to eat, but writing about it seriously was not something that had dawned on me at all. So it started there. And I started writing more articles, and for Gourmet and for other magazines, and traveling with the magazines and for the magazines and writing for them. And it was at that time that somebody said, would you like to do a cookbook? It was like a roving editor, somebody who didn't have a publisher, but just thought maybe I can sell a book for hers. And then he vanished, and the book was sold to a publisher, but they went belly up. So then this book went through the editor of Pantheon at that time, whom I knew slightly, to Judith directly. And Judith said, come, let's talk. I love what you're writing. And she just encouraged me to just be myself. And I remember in that first book, she said, whatever you've done, I love. Now, what I need you to do is Americans don't know what to eat with what. So if you have a recipe, tell them. Tell them what you would eat it with. How would you eat it? So she guided me in very practical ways to sell the book in a way to Americans. She was attracted by it. And she, I remember her saying, you must cook for Julia Child. Now, Julia Child was very interesting. She had interest in some foods and none in others. She was interested in Chinese food. She liked Chinese food. And, of course, she liked French food and American food. But Indian food, she had no great love for. But I cooked myself to death for her. I just made a huge meal. And we were in Judith's house, Judith encouraging me all the way through, and served it to Julia. And she was very kind. She was very nice. But it was not her cup of tea, and I didn't know whether to be encouraged or discouraged. But Judith said, look, you've got something to say, and I want your book, and you're going to do it. So I did it, and then she had me do more books and more books and more books. And her editing style, I mean, I see other people have talked about her green editing. She edited with a green pencil, and she wrote you notes with a green pen. And one word from her, I think other people also have remarked on it. I remember at the end of a sentence, it was really a paragraph that I wrote in my memoir. She had written in pencil after that last paragraph. She wrote, nice. And that just made you feel as if God had cupped you in his hands and kissed you.
That's so funny. So the first...
It just felt wonderful when she wrote nice.
Oh.
And you know you had struggled with the words and, you know, images, and suddenly it was all worth it.
So your first book was An Invitation to Indian Cooking.
That's right.
I read that she came up with that title, which is such a lovely title.
She did. I did not. I could not think of a title. In fact, I was going to call it Curry, Myth, and Reality. And she said to me, that's going to be filed in the bookshops in the philosophy section. So we don't want that.
So I'm so curious, knowing, you know, we have our cookbook coming out in the fall, and now understanding the process a little bit more, how was it back then in terms of the recipe testing, and was Judith involved in that?
You know, when I was doing, I think, what is that book? I'll just tell you the title. I forget the titles of my own books.
Invitation to Indian Cooking.
The Yellow Book, At Home with Malhar Jaffe.
Uh-huh.
She was in Vermont. She spent the entire summers in Vermont. And she said, the pictures are going to be taken, and you'll have to cook all the dishes. I said, oh, my Lord, I have to cook all the dishes, and I have no help here. I was in the country myself, which is sort of part of the way down for her towards New York. And she said, I'll come and help you. So she came, she stayed with me, she cooked with me, and got the dishes ready for the photographer. And so, you know, it didn't bother her to pull up her sleeves and start cooking. And she sort of helped me along. So there were the two of us cooking all the food for the photograph.
And back then, what was it like trying to find Indian ingredients?
Indian ingredients could always be found, but not all things. There were some ingredients that, I think as time went on, more and more ingredients became available, to the point that now you can get organic everything from India. But we got things like the curry leaf. In the early days, curry leaf was not available, so I just didn't use it in my recipes. But as time went on, almost everything has become available, and because of the internet, you can get everything everywhere. You can just send for it.
And how much of that do you credit to Judith and her influence?
Well, I think it's her encouraging the books she liked, and which were all not straight American or French food. They were all the books. There were Italian books. There were Chinese books. There were, you know, Japanese books. She did all kinds of books. So I think with the publication of each of these, more ingredients became commonly known and therefore more easily available.
I mean, it's so apparent how she championed women and the incredible list of women that she edited. But some people have said she really sought out storytellers and great cooks.
She sought out storytellers. She picked women of strength and independence who had minds of their own. People like us, a whole lot of us, are, you know, considered rather, how shall I put it? But it's a society that doesn't easily accept ambitious women. And she encouraged us. She encouraged all of us because we had individual voices, individual ways of putting things, individual thoughts that were not, they were clean, clear thoughts that were different from other people. She wasn't afraid of it one bit. And she let us put them down in our own way. And I think that's entirely to her credit.
Well, you're certainly part of a major sorority.
Yes.
Did you ever get together for a dinner?
I went to her house in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Sanford and I went up there because we knew her and Evan. We often went out and saw each other, just the four of us. So my husband got to know Evan very well, and so she had invited us one weekend to her place in Vermont, which was very, very much her. Speaking, as it were, plain, wonderful house with nature all around.
Was there ever a dinner with you and Lydia and Julia and Edna?
We went to things together. Like Lydia would invite several of us to her restaurant. We did that several times.
Oh, that's fun. Well, speaking of which, we actually, if you don't mind staying on the phone for a few more minutes, we have Lydia on the other line. You two can say hi. Lydia?
Yes, I would like to. I would like to.
Lydia Bastianich?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Lydia. This is Madhur here.
Hi, Madhur. How you doing? I was listening to you a bit. Yes, we lost a dear, dear friend and a muse, and she was a lot of things, especially to us women cookbook writers.
I know. I was just saying that it's the end of an era. There was nobody like her. Editors like her don't exist now.
I think of, once she retired, you know, I thought of my blessings. The fact that I had this great opportunity to work with her, to be led by her, it's a very special part of my life.
Yes, yes.
Lydia, tell us how you and Judith came into each other's orbits.
Well, you know, I guess right at my third book, you know, you usually when you write a book, then you put it out there. And Knopf was very interested, but particularly Judith, because she was the one that actually chose the chef that she wanted or writers that she wanted to work with, and she had a keen sense of kind of finding out those special people, and she made sure that she stood by them for their successes.
And what was the editing process like for you?
The what?
The editing process. People have talked about Judith and her famous green pen and her notes.
Well, the ending, I mean, Judith was involved in every aspect of the book. She was in the concept, in the idea, in the, of course, the chapters, in the recipe. Then we tested the recipes many a time. She came over my house. I went over her apartment in the city. I went up to Vermont, and we tested the recipes. And she was there until the very end. The design, she was in every part of the book. And she was blunt. You know, she would tell you. But you know what? She was right every single time.
So Madhur was telling us that you sometimes brought together her authors for dinners at your restaurants.
Oh, we did, you know, because we kind of crossed paths. First of all, you know, as professionals, as our books and book signing sometimes together, but also in the office, you know, we would come and visit her, and in and out, we would cross paths. And then, you know, I thought, you know, it would just be nice to sit down, especially to honor her, for her to have these kind of individuals that she really built into writers. Because, you know, when I started, I was not a writer. I put things down, I did recipes, but I was no writer. And you know what she said to me? She said, Lydia, she said, just put it all down. The editing is my part. I want everything that you have on your mind on that special subject, put it down. Because I think the problem with anybody trying to write anything is that they edit themselves before they put it down. You know, kind of you edit in your mind. And she kind of liberated me. And I put it all down, and then her and I, we went through it, and she edited it, and she says, I want you to focus on this and this. And she led me down the path of creating great books.
What would you say, what would each of you say was Judith's biggest contribution to the food world?
I think she was very instrumental in the way America eats today. She was connected to food in a visceral way, in a simple, straightforward way. And I think she got that somewhat like Julia did, living in France, and kind of living not the complex French food, but the simple country cooking and the products, the importance of the products and of the season and of the place where the products come from. And she came back and she said, you know, this is the way America has got to learn how to cook. And she picks on us one by one that have somewhat those qualities. You know, Madra certainly, her Indian food, I did in my Italian. She was very conscious about the different ethnicities because that's what America is. But she got into every single ethnic food really viscerally.
Madhur, how about you? What do you think was Judith's biggest contribution?
Think one of the things she focused on and liked was home cooking. You know, things that people make at home. They could be complicated dishes or simple dishes, but things that originated in the home, not in a so-called, I hate to use the words, but a chef's mind. She really preferred original homey recipes. And I think she encouraged those cooks who cooked those kind of familiar and familial home recipes. She encouraged them and liked their work very much. And I think part of her was put off by the sort of raspberry vinegar and all the newfangled things that people were creating. There was something about her that like tried and true traditional foods. She was never afraid, for example, of eating butter. Till the very end, she said, I'm going to sit down by myself with a glass of wine and some bread and butter and, you know, unafraid of the things that everybody grew up with and everybody still enjoyed. And I think that's what her greatest contribution is, that those are the kind of people. I mean, Lydia was amongst the best of those. She was converting her home dishes into restaurant food, and it was wonderful. So that's the kind of thing I think she loved, and I think she liked people like me and Edna Lewis, who were really cooking in a style that was very personal and to a region, belonged to completely to a region.
So we also have Joan Nathan on the line. Joan, are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me?
We can. I thought it would be fun to have all three of you on the phone. So, Joan, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, Joan. Madhur here.
Oh, hi, Madhur.
Hi, Joan. This is Lydia.
Oh, hi, Lydia.
We've never had three legends on the phone before, so this is a very exciting moment for us in the studio. Joan, how are you today? I'm so sorry about the loss of your friend Judith.
Oh, well, it's been a bad week. But I'm sitting on Martha's Vineyard right where she had dinner with me and looking outside at the ocean, something she'd love to do. So there we are.
Tell us about your relationship with Judith.
Well, I wish I had listened to everybody else's. She was tough. I loved her green pencil, where she said nice when you wrote something that maybe we thought was really great, but nice for her was a very nice thing. She was full of spunk and of life. My most favorite things were working on my books with her. I'm sure Madhur and Lydia have said the same thing up in Vermont. And traveling with her to Israel and to France and seeing, and she was always up for everything.
What was your first book that you worked on with her?
Jewish Cooking in America.
And do you remember the experience? Did you work in her office?
Well, what happened was she came to me to ask me if I'd like to write a book on how Jewish immigrants reacted to American food and how Americans reacted to Jewish food. And I thought it was a great idea. It was part of her Knopf Cooks American series. And then I worked on my own. I was so afraid to call her. And I handed in a manuscript. And I remember this so distinctly. She called me on the phone and you didn't do email. I guess you did, but it was in the early 90s. And she said, you better come to New York. I don't understand what you are doing. And I almost fell through the floor. But, she wasn't so strictly admonishing, but she was carefully admonishing. And within 5 minutes, I realized what I had done wrong in the book. And thank goodness for computers in those days. I turned it around, and it won the Julia Child Prize as Best Cookbook of the Year.
So wait, you have to tell us, what were you doing wrong?
Well, I was doing it as a historic narrative rather than as a cookbook. And I realized that people want to read cookbooks, and you can put the history within, within blocks, within a context. But basically, it's a cookbook.
So I asked Mater and Lydia the same question. But what do you think is Judith's legacy?
Oh, I think at a time before all the TV superstars, she first of all, Julia Child is her big legacy, and Anne Frank, and but she also, as far as the cookbook world is concerned, she found people like Lydia and Madhur and other people, so many, Marcella Hazan, that were cooks at home and really had no, we didn't think of television at all in those days, that wanted to have a platform for their books. And when I started writing, Madhur Jaffrey was a giant for me. And the cookbooks, you looked up to Barbara Kafka, Marcella, Madhur. Now, of course, people are so infatuated with superstar chefs. But it wasn't like that then. And she gave a platform for ordinary but really good cooks to tell their story. And I think that's what her ultimate legacy will be. And, and she's probably the last of that kind of... She's the last, as I think Madhur said, last of an era.
So I want to ask each of you this. If for all the young home cooks and food enthusiasts out there listening, what's one way that you can remember Judith this weekend? Madhur, what could someone do?
Well, I think just cook from any of the cookbooks that we've been talking about. Just pick up a recipe, a simple recipe, and just make it and see the joys of using good ingredients cooked in very often fairly simple ways to make a great, great meal. Open a glass of wine, put butter on your roll, and toast.
Lydia, how about you? What's something that we could do this weekend that would make Judith smile?
I think pick up the book of one of her authors and pick a recipe that really rings to that individual, that you feel that you can really do it because she edited it so, she had us write it so that it is quite doable, simple, and straightforward. And cook with all your heart in your kitchen in her honor. And if you have a dog, a little dog by you, she would appreciate that. She loved her little dog. And by all means, have a glass of wine and just sit down and, toast to Judith, because she made many of an American kitchen a kitchen that one eats well, a kitchen that one can cook recipes. She gave confidence through us, the writers.
And Joan, what's your suggestion?
Well, my suggestion, both of what you said is exactly what I would suggest. But in addition, I think people should do something that's a little bit out of the ordinary, that they wouldn't do or usually, and do it with flair. Because Judith was a really gutsy person who liked to have a lot of fun. And she really didn't care if she went against the grain. And maybe that's what made her so special. But I think that's what I would do. Have a little fun.
Well, thank you. Madhur, Lydia, and Joan, we're such fans of all three of yours, and thank you for calling in, and thank you for all your contributions as well.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
So that's it for today's show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please do one or all of the things that Joan and Lydia and Madhur suggested to remember this life. Judith Jones was such a unique human being. Her legacy is staggering, and I don't know that we'll ever see someone like that again in our lifetimes. Thank you for listening. Radio Cherry Bomb was engineered by the one and only Dave Tatasciore. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. And thank you to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review for Radio Cherry Bomb on iTunes or Stitcher. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And it's your chance to influence our fall season, which we're planning right now. Thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'm Janae Pohl, and I'm the Director of Operations at Blue Marble Ice Cream, which is New York City's only certified organic ice cream brand. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Caroline Schiff, Executive Pastry Chef at Scoops and Sweets in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Not only is she an absolute genius, but her hair is always on point and her cakes are absolutely the best in town.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.